It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
This week, the government is set to declare a climate emergency, joining almost 30 other countries who have made the same declaration. The first country to declare a climate emergency was Scotland in 2019. However, smaller organisations and other institutions have made similar declarations since 2016. So, I begin by asking James what this decision means for the government and Aotearoa as a whole.
Well, one of the reasons why we've been a little reluctant to say it any earlier is because, you know, a statement by itself without any plan for actually doing anything about climate change is just more hot air. And, you know, we don't want to be one of those countries that just says something with no intention of following through. So it really is about how we make sure that the whole of government is lined up and doing the things that it's supposed to do to both bend the downward curve on our emissions and also prepare communities for the effects of climate change around the country.
So the next step, I suppose, is to set priorities for mitigating the climate crisis. As the Minister for Climate Change, what do you think needs to change first?
Well, the main thing that we've got to this is one of those things that's got to happen everywhere, right? But if I had to pick three, it would be transport, where our emissions have been going up and up and up over the course of the last 30 years. A lot of the rest of the economy, our emissions are high, but at least they're flat. But in transport, they've just been increasing constantly, and so we really do need to get on top of that. Also, agricultural emissions, which obviously make up about half of the country's total, where we're starting to see some action, but again, that's got to pick up pace. And then the other one is in energy that we use in our industry. So things like, we've got all these coal-fired, milk drying units to turn milk into milk powder and so on. And there's an easily substitutable technology, but it is quite an expensive undertaking. So I think those are three areas where we've got an existing technology. We just need to work out how to finance the transition and what speed to do it in.
And the Green Party does have quite extensive plans for these things. On the note of transport, I want to talk a little bit about the Greens' Future of Transport plan, which hopes to not lock everyone into having to constantly use cars. It said that this is hoped to also power the post-COVID recovery. If this is to be, how quickly would this plan need to be implemented?
Well, some of the things that are in that are, the groundwork was actually laid in the last term through the work that my colleague Julian Genter did with Phil Twyford. What we want to do is to persuade the government to basically direct more of its COVID recovery towards transport infrastructure, and in particular multimodal transport infrastructure, the kind that actually uses the land more efficiently, gets people and freight faster around our cities and between our cities and so on. And that is a conversation that, because the government's only just getting up and running, that we're only just getting started.
With the infrastructure that's needed to make new, cleaner transport around the country, it's quite long-term proposals. Is there anything to do with transport that could be done short-term?
Well, there are things that we can do very quickly, right? So one of the things that we were proposing were substantial discounts and in some cases free off-peak travel on public transport. And those are things that could move quite quickly and that would start to get people out of their vehicles and into more efficient forms of transport faster. And whilst you're making that shift, then you can start to lay down the plans for, you know, longer-term projects like light rail through our cities. Cycleways are also reasonably quick to set up and run. And where we've got cycleways, particularly in Auckland, you've seen, you know, bicycle usage increase by several orders of magnitude. So I think bicycle use in Auckland is up something like 500% on only a few years ago before we started building all those cycleways through the city.
Yeah, I do personally quite like those bike lanes. So thanks for that. You also mentioned agriculture as one of the top three things that you think need to change first. You have the Farming for Future plan. Farming is often a site of contention in New Zealand politics. Do you think that with the Labour government now having a majority, that will allow for more change to come through?
Well, I think the situation is such that we set up this relationship with the farming community in the last term, and we said, OK, look, you've said that you want to own the solution. you know, we're giving you the ability to do that. They have been working for about a year now on developing a system for measuring, managing and pricing emissions at the level of each individual farm, and that's supposed to start getting rolled out around over the course of the coming years, to the point where every single farm has one of these systems in place by 2024, and the pricing mechanism kicks in from 2025. The thing that I think is that, you know, in addition to that system, there's actually been a ton of research over the last several years on things that we can do with existing technology and existing science. And actually, a lot of farms around the country have, in changing their practices at the farm level, have actually not only been able to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, in some cases quite dramatically, but also to increase their profitability. So whilst we're building this farm-level system, I would like to see us move faster on commercialising the research that we've already done.
And a big part of the Farming for Future plan is to work with farmers to create change, and that's positive for the environment and, as you said, positive for them. What's the response from farmers been like overall to this plan?
Well, it's mixed, but ultimately I think the vast majority of farmers that I've come into contact with over the course of the last few years recognise that there is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and they want to be the ones that deal with it. And so the question is, well, what is the best way to ensure that that happens and that it is robust and that it does get the kind of change that we want? And that's why we're working through industry organisations that have got contact with basically every farmer in the country, depending on which organisation you're talking to. And that, I think, it will start to yield results in the course of this Parliament coming up.
I'd like to move now to some more international questions. The Five Eyes Intelligence Network made a joint statement which said Beijing was trying to silence political opposition in the Chinese territory, and the country's called for China to immediately reinstate recently fired members of Hong Kong's legislature, and said new rule changes appeared to be part of a campaign to silence critical voices. There was quite a negative response from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, which said it doesn't matter whether they have five eyes or ten. If they dare to damage China's sovereignty, security and development, they should be careful or their eyes will be plucked out. Firstly, the Greens oppose the Five Eyes Intelligence Network, and I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about why this is.
Well, the issue that we've had with it is we're always concerned about information that's gathered by New Zealand intelligence agencies and is shared with other countries that don't have as robust approach to human rights as we do, such as the United States. And so that's really behind our kind of long-standing concern there. And also, I guess, a general wariness in a world where we try to maintain an independent foreign policy, that we don't end up sort of becoming, I don't know, a pawn in somebody else's chess game, if you like. So that's always been behind our caution there. I think the recent moves by those five countries, I think this is one of the other things that's happening at the moment, is that there's a bit of a blurring between an intelligence relationship and a sort of a diplomatic relationship between those five countries. And obviously, you know, we sort of see ourselves as an independent country and part of a much bigger network of countries than just those five. But China has adopted a more robust approach recently, and they are violating their legal commitments in Hong Kong. And so I think that's where the statement came from, was the sense that, well, they had actually agreed under a treaty when Hong Kong was transferred from the former colonial power of Britain to China, that Hong Kong would have essentially self-management, if you like, for the next 50 years. And it does appear that China's going back on that treaty.
The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Nanaia Mahuta, said that she couldn't assess whether the statement was a threat and that words could be interpreted in many ways. What's your interpretation of the response from the Chinese government to this Five Eyes statement?
Well, my sense is that the So they are, like I said, they are adopting a much more robust approach internationally, and they are using stronger language, and they are testing the boundaries in Hong Kong and the South China Sea and with Taiwan and Tibet and so on, and the Uyghurs in Western China and the Xinjiang region. And they are very defensive about, you know, other countries sort of calling them out on what they see as domestic affairs. But ultimately, I think the concern here is that, you know, the Chinese government has never had a particularly strong approach to human rights, you know, we're concerned perhaps with the void that Donald Trump's administration has created, that they are taking that opportunity to go further than they have in the past.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.